there is a big interest at the moment in science, in getting in computation. Everything is becoming computational, computational biology, computational physics, etc., etc. So I wanted to point out a couple of things about the advent of multicore, the arrival of it in science, and what kind of repercussions I could identify there. I recently did my PhD here, and I'm now, I did my PhD with the McDiarmid Institute, and I'm now working for a company called Magritech, still in conjunction with the university. They're a spin-off company. They don't live very far away from the original research group. Anyhow, so the outline is a bit brief. I'm just going to show you a couple of examples of what scientists have always done with parallel computing. 20, 30 years ago, with the first big machines, the craze, they've always done multicore stuff there, but there was a very small subset of scientists that did that. Now, what is the impact of multicore in your office machine? What kind of impact does that have in science? It's a question I want to briefly comment on and conclude. So, just to show you some examples, that's a picture from Wikipedia on gravitational lensing. There's a guy at Victoria University, quite well known in his field, who does a lot of this kind of stuff. What you see is you see a galaxy on the top right sending light towards Earth. We don't see the light from that galaxy directly. We see it through a lens. That lens is mass in between, which bends the light and thereby acts as a lens. So we see several copies of the same galaxy reaching us from various different directions. And now the task is to find out what kind of lens was in between, what kind of lens caused the distortion we observe. So that's the idea in gravitational lensing. Now the computational way to approach that problem is to simply try out many different arrangements of mass to find one that fits well. So you can see where the parallelization is going here. Right? So you could either just brute force plenty of different guesses, or you just employ something meta-heuristic like a genetic algorithm or something along those lines. So that's one of those exemplary problems in high-performance computing, where you typically don't employ your office machine. Another one, simulations based on lattices, where you have lattice sites which have a property, in this case spin up, spin down, simulating magnetism. These lattices can be huge. In particular, they can be 1, 3, 4D, so they and various degrees of freedom for each property per lattice site. And these properties propagate from one lattice site to the neighbors, maybe only to the nearest neighbors typically, but often in some cases to neighbors further away as well. You compute some properties from there. You can compute phase changes of materials and all these kind of things. It's important, very important model, the Ising model here for magnetism. And these lattices can be massive, so you run into a memory problem on them, not just into a computational problem, but into a memory problem. And on top of that, if you split it on a cluster, if you have a data parallel array, then you have a communication problem as well. So that's one of these models that have been used in physics 20 years ago already on parallel computers. Another one, Monte Carlo methods. You just have a bunch of, in this example here, that's the aggregation of colloids, which are like little spheres, smaller than the wavelength of light, very small, very hard to observe what they're actually doing in a solution, and they bounce around the water. These spheres at some point aggregate and precipitate from the solution. You want to understand how they do it, what the dynamics of that are. You can use kinetic Monte Carlo for that, where you just pick a sphere at random, move it in a random direction, and see whether it kind of hits another sphere. And if so, then you could decide, does it stick to it or not, or does it, if there's any electric repulsion between the two, should it go the other way or not? Is the overall energy in the system increased or decreased. If it's decreased, then that's cool, because all systems tend to go to their lowest energy state. You accept that and move on to the next random sphere. If it's increased, then you accept that only with a probability that has something to do with the temperature. So typically, you are talking about millions and millions of iterations. So that's one of these high-performance problems where you have a data problem. Like these lattices can be big, and where you have a problem you need just many, many subsequent iterations, and you cannot jump forward halfway and give another processor that task to do because it doesn't know what the previous state was. So, again, something to think about in terms of how to parallelize these things properly. One of the favorites, molecular mechanics, many, many atoms all interacting with one another, similar to the Monte Carlo, but etc. Different in the sense that you don't move between letter sides. Now you can move at any continuous variable, like at any position in 3D space. These atoms all interact. What is shown here is the uptake of a little metal palladium cluster into a carbon nanotube, which is important to understand how these carbon nanotubes grow, which is important again because these carbon nanotubes have very funky properties, and we all want to have as much things made of carbon nanotubes as we can think of. We just don't know it yet. So these molecular mechanics, the question here again is how to parallelize them properly. How do you assign, for example, one way be to just assign one set of atoms to one processor, another set of atoms to another, but now you want to do that as efficiently as possible. That's one of the things that comes to mind on how to parallelize these problems. People have done it, though. For example, fairly recent, I don't know why that was published in the Journal of High Explosive and Organic Materials, but nonetheless, yeah, it's cool. Yeah, 320 billion atom simulation. That's massive from a computational and also on a scientific scale. That's massive. They basically can simulate almost bulk metal. Bulk in the sense that it's a little cube with micrometer length scale, which is still fairly small, but from a scientific point of view, humongous. So, yeah, that's the current edge there. Another one, quantum chemistry. Sounds funky, but what it is you use quantum theory to simulate chemical properties of molecules. For example, this is a molecule, benzene thiol. What are plotted here are various different isosurfaces of the overall electron density. It's actually not just plotted. I used Blender as well. So that's, you simulate the electron density. You can infer from the electron density a large amount of properties. You can apply perturbations, like how does that density change if you apply a field in one direction or an electric field in the other direction. What happens if one of the natural perturbations, one of the natural vibrations in the molecules is undergoing? What kind of perturbation do you see then? You can compute what color the element has, what wavelength it scatters, etc. So we can learn a whole bunch of things. We can even compute things about molecules we can't synthesize, so that we don't know whether they exist, basically, except in the computer. We haven't managed, chemists haven't managed to make it, but we know, you know, potentially it's out there. The problem being, with all these problems, that some of them, what I've shown you, obviously, are the results, so we can compute them. But in basically all of them, we wish for more. We basically say, hey, I want to compute a molecule that is 10 times that size, and I want to have it sitting on a lattice of metal atoms that is a micrometer wide or something like that on each edge. So at the moment, that's completely out of the question at that level of theory. And these algorithms, some of them scale well, some of them scale not so well. There is a huge amount of work to be done in terms of parallelization. It's hard enough to wrap your head around the the physical theory, then applying that to how to compute it is basically the next level. And there's a lot of work that could be done there. So, coming to the second point, highly scientific graph that I drew by hand, the number of people that have a particular computational literacy. So that's kind of the argument I want to make here. There are many, 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 many problems that we are solving in science. But the question is, should scientists do more? Because if you look at the average person, I would argue you get something like that. You get a whole bunch of people who can find the on-off button, but you can get only very, very few who are going to install Gentoo on their laptops. Now, with scientists, in relative terms, you'd expect a little bit more. You'd expect a few more to be able to do a little bit of programming, who know Fortran or who have at least heard that there are more than one, possibly more than one core in a computer. But what you get instead of that slightly darker blue curve, what you get is that. This is what I find you get. You get a whole bunch of people who know the on-off button, who can do Word and Excel, and then it pretty quickly goes into a valley, where I call it the valley of willful ignorance, where they basically say, I don't want to know about that. I've got other things to do. Scientists work very long hours, often there on the weekend, and they just want to mask out things that they think they shouldn't be interested in because it's a waste of their time. It's publish and perish in science. You need to publish as quickly as you can and as much as you can, otherwise you will not get your next appointment or not your tenure or whatever.
Matthias, the only thing that you need to scale is time.
Yes, I hope so.
No.
But
give me a 30 seconds wrap up and impress us.
Right. After the what I call that valley of willful ignorance, you get these people over here, which have always been interested in these kind of things. These are the physicists, scientists who've always been interested in computers. So who've done that 20 years ago, basically before things arrived. Now the question is what to do with that situation. One of the key points is education. So my message to you guys is whenever you can identify a problem that can be parallelized and you have something like threading building blocks or view-oriented this or parallel programming, then why don't you do some outreach and try to get in touch with scientists and say, hey, I know how to do that. I know how to speed up your program by a factor of 10. And thereby, I can advocate how cool my system is. You get your publication, and you know, it's give and take. We all win. So that's one thing. Outreach, please do it if you can.
I appreciate it. I'm terribly sorry because
running out of time.
No, you already run. But what about if you go to the last slide?
Right.
Straightforward.
Right. Okay. So. What I identify as the conclusion, basically, in high-performance computing, we're very strongly problem-dependent on how to parallelize things or not. We need some true computational scientists who only focus on that. You need funding for that. Then, with every office computer having two or four cores, or in the future more, you have a whole bunch of idle hardware. How to use that? Boeing project and the Condo project, for example. We need more people to do that. So education will help that, but you need to find funding for that. And one way to do it would be if compute programmers would outreach more to science and say, hey, let's solve that problem.
Let me propose you that to discuss this at the birth of a feather.
Yeah.
And may I ask you guys to join me to say thank you to Matthew. Not sure what I'm doing here, but that's my name. So
well, you me.
So that's to blame me for just stop there. Timo, our next speaker will be on. scope of Linux mobile devices. We have this couple of seconds of change with machines, and there are a few guys in the back. There are a lot of seats here empty. I think that I told you that it will be 10 to 5 a panel about the topic of the mini conference. Timo is from Germany. I think that is his third visit to New Zealand. He will tell us a little bit about that. And I think that he told me that he studies in a university with a name that I cannot pronounce, but with the first professor in open source in Germany. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Sorry.
Okay.
I was just getting the laptop.
And then when I found that name of that professor, and I think that wrote something on his blog, someone from Wellington answered, "Oh, I know that guy." So that just shows that we are a small family. All yours.
Thank you, Nicholas. So let me quickly introduce myself. I'm trying to catch up the couple of minutes we just lost, but I'll continue on where Matthias stopped. So I'll tell you how we can use the idle resources for mobile devices. I'm working for SUSE and Novell for 5 years now, and last November I've switched to part-time in order to follow my PhD at the University of Erlangen in Nuremberg. That, in this case, has nothing to do with the programming language Erlang, which is coming from a Dutch guy, I think. So if we look at mobile devices, we can look at those two examples. One is a prototype from a company called Xerox, planned in 1968, and another one is an actual product, which is from a company called Lidl. It's a webbook, which was sold in 2009, since 2009. And I was pretty amazed when I saw these two pictures, that we have like 40 years between those two pictures. And I was wondering, what did we achieve? What did we do? So actually, we achieved a lot. If we look at the laptops and PDAs, those are basically the systems I'm defining as mobile devices. We started off with the Osborne 1 in 1980, and we've come a far way until we now have Android devices, small pocket-sized computer who can do anything in our only life. Yes, please? I think the Osborne 1 wasn't even shipped with a battery. But there was a second company which sold a battery as a third party accessory, and I think that was pretty huge. Oh, that was 1968. That was a prototype. They didn't even build it. So today's talk will be split into three parts, about what we have achieved, what we are currently doing, where we have failed, and what we are going to do tomorrow. So I have looked at the numbers, at the plain numbers, facts and factors of mobile computing during the last years, and we see a huge amount increasement in clock speed, RAM, storage and bandwidth. However, there's also another number where we dramatically have failed, and that's battery life. If we look at battery life, we only improved by a factor of 10. Compared to bandwidth, which was increased by the factor 10 to the power of 6. So it's obvious we have a problem with battery life, and that didn't went unnoticed. So if we look at the first spy shot, which went onto the internet in December last month, of the new Google phone, people immediately were concerned about battery life. They were not concerned about the features the device might have, but they are only concerned about battery life. And that can conclude to the fact, thing that we have a common problem for both PDAs, phones, and laptop computers. It's battery life. So when I was thinking about what we could improve, I first looked at our common power management stack, which I've shown here. So if we split the software into the Linux kernel part and the user space part, we have a lot of tiny bits which actually do the power management for the device we are running. So we have device drivers taking care of the hardware power management functionality. We have ACPI on the x86 architecture for power management features. We have a couple of governors driving the CPU frequency and a lot of other stuff in the Linux kernel. On the user space side, we have, again, a lot of software running, like a policy daemon, which is controlling and saying which user is allowed to do what functionality on the power management. We have a lot of other code, like idle detection, graphical interfaces. So we do a whole lot of stuff there. One problem is that this stack is quite complex and it's fragile. So if we break one of the things, for example, a simple application in user space, which is needlessly polling for a device on a device, we cannot do much in below the stack in the software, firmware, or hardware to fix it. So we have to fix the application. And that's what I and others in this area have been doing over the last years. However, I'm advocating that this is not enough, because all this is only bringing the factor 10, and that's just not enough. If we look at the characteristics of network links which are utilized by mobile devices, I thought that there might be a chance that we can do better by utilizing network links. So if we look at the past and present of the characteristics of network links, so it used to be an impermanent connection we had to deal with. It was very low bandwidth, and it was very expensive with regard to money, and that has changed. It has improved. So we have permanent connection to at least one link, like GSM, 3G, Wi-Fi, I don't know what. We usually have quite high bandwidth, so we can really utilize the link, and it's gotten very cheap. So at least in Europe, we are used to a flat rate, so fixed price for a line, even if it's a mobile one. What hasn't changed is the high power drain of the network link. So whenever we are receiving data or sending data, we always drain a lot of power. Oh, sorry. So all what I'm saying is, by this shift from